You'll probably during the exile, and a fascinating psalm, especially the way it ends. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows, there we hung up our lyres, for there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. Let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, how they said, "Lay it bare! Lay it bare, down to its foundations. O daughter of Babylon, doomed to be destroyed, blessed shall he be who repays you with what you have done to us. Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock." And thus we begin, O God, with a psalm that ends with a very disturbing image, but a brutal reminder of what it's like when the presence of God leaves his people and expels them to a foreign land. Help us today to hear the Spirit of God through more difficult words in the book of Ezekiel. Help us to enter in and hear the sufferings of the exiled people and to hear the judgment of Yahweh upon them and to rise and sing when we see how you restore the fortunes of your people through your presence coming and returning. So give us new ears to hear and new eyes to see what you have to say through one of the most disturbing books in the Old Testament in many ways, but one of the most important. It's in the name of the triune God we pray these things. Amen. So welcome to week 6 of this small group Bible study that we're in with Ezekiel. Ezekiel, in my mind, I was telling this to Keith a few minutes ago, I think Ezekiel is actually one of, if not the single most important book in the entire Old Testament in terms of the story of the Bible. Ezekiel brings out some things and completes some things that no other book in the Bible does, like Ezekiel. And so that book that is rarely preached on, rarely studied, rarely talked about in the church is in fact one of the most life-giving waters to the church that we cannot ignore. And my purpose today is to help us just again to see, as we're studying all these books, it's just a reminder that we're trying to see these books from the perspective of the ancient reader himself or herself. So I want us to feel how the ancient Israelite is hearing these things coming through and what God is doing through that. Because it's only that way, when we're reading kind of from the Old Testament forward, then we can actually see how the New Testament writers are reading the Old Testament and how things are changing and what they're doing and how they're applying this great storyline that's just hovering through the Old Testament, how they're applying it to the New Testament. And there's no better place to see that than in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel is a precious, beautiful, and very weird, disturbing book. So with that, I'm curious to hear, for those of you who have been reading Ezekiel or read Ezekiel in the past, what has been kind of your... What's been your impressions of this book? what has captivated you, or what has disturbed you, or maybe you're just kind of like, what the world is going on in this book? Dave?
The very graphic, very disturbing imagery, some of which I think, if you picked out passages, paragraphs, and showed it to people, they would probably think a Christian shouldn't read those kind of things, not even recognizing that it's biblical.
So Dave said the very graphic, disturbing language, and he said that if you just kind of cut out a paragraph and showed it to somebody, they wouldn't even think it was part of the Bible, right? That's right. Ezekiel is, let me say it this way. Your English Bibles, trust me on this, are very sensitive and hide a lot. It is even more graphic than you realize. Ezekiel is well known among some communities as having the most Semitic cuss words of any book of the Bible. You think I'm kidding, I'm not. It's also known as the book that if you were to read it carefully and see what's going on, we would classify today sections of it as raw pornography. Chapter 16, for instance, we'll talk about some. There are some very shocking images in the book of Ezekiel. It is not a clean book. And it's maybe one reason why the church has struggled at times. And when I say the church, I'm not meaning ECC, I'm just meaning the church. The church has struggled at times to know just what to do with this thing. How to preach it. How do you preach chapter 16 about whoredom? How do you preach? I heard that Dave was reading chapter 2 and 3 and decided to go out and gather some food like Ezekiel and cook it on some dung. You know, there's a personal application for you to go home with from the book of Ezekiel. So yeah, what else did you read in Ezekiel that you saw that disturbed you, or that you liked, or you saw interesting, just when you're reading this book? Maury.
Son of man, I tried to find it, and here it is.
Yes, yeah. Did see him just struggling, trying to figure out how to say this. And this is one reason why just this language rises to the surface that we don't normally use, and we don't talk like. As we see the prophet struggling himself.
The vision of the dry bones always just—it terrified me. It still does, you know, visually.
Yeah, yeah. So Ezekiel chapter 37. That's probably the most famous text, maybe from Ezekiel. The valley of dry bones, and imagine, you know, standing in a graveyard and bones just kind of rising up in front of you, and. Ezekiel 37 is a interesting chapter. It's, I think, as we'll see today, is actually one of the highest, most glorious parts of the book of Ezekiel, in fact. And when we read these bones rising out of the grave, we should be up there shouting with joy, as Ezekiel is. We'll see that today some. So Let's look briefly at the background to Ezekiel, which is very important to understand this book. We have now entered fully in to the exilic period. Jeremiah was prophesying at least 20 years before the exile happened. We had Zephaniah, who was prophesying at least about 20 years before. Now Jeremiah, as we saw last week, actually continued into the exilic period. But Ezekiel alone is the prophet of the exile. God calls him in the exile, and his ministry is through the exilic time period. So, as a kind of a reminder, we've talked about this before. Essentially, the exile begins in 598, 597, roughly. And you have this horrible event where Nebuchadnezzar comes, and he doesn't destroy Jerusalem, but we know from archaeology that he certainly destroys almost all of Judea around Jerusalem, wipes it out, takes all sorts of leaders away, including Ezekiel, who was, it seems like, if you read it closely, it seems like he was in training to be a priest one day. It doesn't seem like he was yet a priest, but that he was actually in training to be a priest. So most of the exiles are taken all around the Mediterranean, Mesopotamian world, sorry. Ezekiel's taken, if you can see on the map here, right to this region right here. So here's the Persian Gulf, modern Persian Gulf. And then you have the Tigris and the Euphrates River here. And there's this canal that goes actually around Nippur. You can't really see it on the map here, but it comes off this branch right here. Most scholars think this is the Kibar Canal, which is where Ezekiel and some people are taken. But we know from other evidence that there are pockets of Jews taken down in this region, all the way up through the old ruins of Nineveh and up through this. So this entire Mesopotamian region, there are little pockets of Jews that actually lasted for centuries after, who never returned back to Jerusalem when they have the opportunity. So for instance, the book of Esther addresses this. And as a bit of a foreshadow to the book of Esther, when we get to that maybe next year sometime, one of the problems in Esther is that the Jews did not return. And that's kind of playing behind the lines in that book. So Ezekiel's part of this, kind of the beginning of this community that Esther later might have been a part of in that sense. So Jerusalem has yet to be destroyed, but there's now Jews living all the way over near the town, the ancient town of Nippur in Babylon. And here's some the archaeological ruins of Nippur, which is the town he would have known of for certain. He would have been around. His visions begin about 5 years after this, in roughly 593, is when the opening visions for Ezekiel take place. So what you have to keep in mind when you're reading Ezekiel, it's been 5 years that they've already lived here. Now, think back to the book of Jeremiah. We talked about this last week. Remember one of the false prophets, Shemaiah, mentioned how the exile is only going to be 2 years, and then you'll all come back, and everything will be okay, and God will restore everything, and we're all going to have a happy life and hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Yay! Well, Jeremiah stands up and says, no, it's a whole lot worse than you think. And it seems like most of the exilic community who went to the Kibar canal region with Ezekiel all believed and thought that the exile would end very quickly and they'd be returned. And they were pretty much convinced that God would not destroy Jerusalem. Because, well, God's Yahweh and He's a great God and He's always taken care of us in the past, so He's not going to wipe us out. Even Ezekiel seems certain that this is just going to end quickly. And what you see happening is Ezekiel himself really resisting wanting to do this work. He doesn't want to call down judgment from God because he himself seems almost uncertain that they've really been this bad, that they deserve this. And what we see in the prophecies of Ezekiel is often God so overtaking Ezekiel, all this language of the Spirit just overcoming him, that Ezekiel has no choice but to do this. And you see this process in which Yahweh almost brings Ezekiel into submission, and Ezekiel being almost forced to recognize that, oh, I guess we really were bad, including me, Ezekiel. So then the unthinkable happens. Visions are going on here of judgment. All the while, Ezekiel may be kind of thinking, well, if they just kind of repent, it'll be over. And this whole thing will kind of blow over and it'll be a bad nightmare that's done. Well, Ezekiel then records the fall of Jerusalem. And it's so horrific that Yahweh also at the same time, Ezekiel's wife dies. And if you read through that, you see how Yahweh commanded and basically sewed up Ezekiel's mouth not to weep over it. And it was not because God hates Ezekiel's wife or something like that, but it was trying to demonstrate to Ezekiel how much anguish is going on here in the fall of Jerusalem and how they should not grieve it because of how horrific the nature of the people are, that they deserved this. And all these things are like going on as Ezekiel is seeing Jerusalem just fall apart. And it's as if God is teaching Ezekiel, this is what real pain looks like, Ezekiel. When all that I've done, I have to destroy. That's real pain, Ezekiel. And he takes him through that. So Jerusalem falls, and then we get more visions that continue for a number of more years, at least till, from what I can see, at least till about 571. So 586 it falls. Visions continue at least till 571. There's some texts that may even be later than that. But presumably Ezekiel dies in this. He dies without any hope realized. He dies without any sense of we really are going to get back. Yet, mingled in this, in the book of Ezekiel, are these glorious visions, the second half of the book, that in the midst of all this destruction, Yahweh is saying, once again, I mean, if you've been in this class this fall, you keep hearing this theme, once again, Yahweh's going to build something out of the ashes. And more so than any other book, Ezekiel makes it clear, it has nothing to do with this stubborn, rebellious people. And that's why God had to destroy Jerusalem. And yet for some unhuman reason, God raises the bones from the dead of Jerusalem. So how does this work from a structure standpoint? The book of Ezekiel begins with the first 24 chapters being, how I read it this way at least, as of one section. And I title this, The Transcendent Glory of Yahweh Removes His Presence from Jerusalem, Bringing Judgment. So sections 1 through 24 basically paints a picture of this is what happens when the presence of Yahweh leaves. You don't want to live in harmony with Yahweh? Fine, I will leave. You can have it what you want it to be like. Then the second section, chapters 25 through 33, the sovereign glory of Yahweh judges all the nations, especially Jerusalem. So chapters 25 through 32 are oracles against nations. And then chapter 33, it climaxes in the way I read it, in this final judgment upon Jerusalem. And Jerusalem becomes the emblem of all the wickedness of all the entire nations put together. And again, it's a shock to Ezekiel to realize, how is it that the people of God who know the Torah, who are supposed to image Yahweh, are in fact worse than all the nations put together? And it's kind of the final blow to Ezekiel, making him kind of realize how offensive their sin is to Yahweh. But then the book ends with what I call the devoted glory of Yahweh. The devoted glory of Yahweh restores the people of God to His presence, bringing life. So these things marry each other. The beginning of the book kind of has this idea that the glory of Yahweh is leaving, bringing judgment. And then the end of the book ends with, no, the glory of Yahweh is devoted to His own purposes, not to the people in this instance. Jeremiah has this kind of theme that God is devoted to His people and is bringing about this new covenant. Ezekiel makes it sound like the people have nothing to do with this, and he's just devoted to his own purposes, for his own reasons, for his own glory, and has not one drop to do with anything about us. But rather, it's all about God's program that he is devoted to doing. For his unexplainable reasons, he restores the people and brings about life. So, let's move into this. The beginning of Ezekiel, chapters 1 through 24. So chapter 1 opens up with this. If you read this, I hope you read this. Maybe I'll put a parenthesis in here. Let me encourage you, be reading these texts. The more you read them when you come here Sunday morning, the more you're going to get out of this. I'm teaching assuming that you have read these texts. Especially with a book like Ezekiel, we just can't go through all the nuts and bolts. Next week, it'll be a little bit easier for you. It'll just be the book of Haggai, 2 chapters, and the book of Malachi, 4 chapters. So 6 chapters total, 1/8 of the book of Ezekiel. So I encourage you to read those two books and be able to have that in your mind as we come to class next week. But Ezekiel opens up with this explosive vision that just kind of shocks us into the book of Ezekiel. So Ezekiel begins with a vision that almost is just indescribable, inexpressible. Talk to me, for those of you who have read chapter 1, what did you see in chapter 1? What did Ezekiel see? What was going on here? You don't need to give a full synthesis, just things that you saw in the text. Like, what are pieces that he sees? Dave.
Gleaming metal.
Gleaming metal. Yes. What else?
I'm trying to figure out how all these wheels connect.
Yeah. So there's like this wheel, then there's somehow a wheel within a wheel. Okay. What else did you see? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Ezekiel himself, what you see here is that Ezekiel himself does not understand what he's seeing. And he's trying to describe something to you that he doesn't even understand. It'd be like us seeing something, it'd be like us seeing somehow some kind of invention that's going to take place 1,000 years from now. The Lord doesn't return. I hope he does. 1,000 years from now, and seeing it for like 2 minutes, and then coming back to you and go, okay, this is what I saw. I saw moving things and floating things. And that one floating thing sort of looked like a cow. No, wait. It looked kind of like a bull. No, wait. It looked kind of like a lion. Or no, actually, it was like an eagle. And you're kind of looking at me going, what the world? When you read Ezekiel 1, you are meant to be confused. Too many commentators read Ezekiel 1 and approach it trying to explain every little detail in Ezekiel 1 and say, well, this refers to this, and this refers to that, and this fits over here, and this over here, and this over there. No, Ezekiel himself doesn't know what he's looking at. Ezekiel himself is sitting there going, what is going on here? He is so flabbergasted by what he sees. Is that, in fact, if you're reading through it, in the Hebrew text, there are all these incomplete sentences. There's like all this like babble. He's like, he just kind of trails off. And then there were four faces over, no, but then there was a shining thing over here, no, up. Then he just kind of stops. It's like he can't even hold himself together trying to explain what it is he's seeing. Until the very end. Notice the very end. What is the vision, in fact, about? Look at verse 28. Like the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain, so is the appearance of the brightness all around. And then you get this kind of pause, and a lot of translations will put a little paragraph break, which is appropriate. But really think of it like a hyphen that goes out, and suddenly he realizes what he's seeing. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of Yahweh. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Ezekiel is in shock as he's trying to describe all this unearthly reality. It suddenly dawns on him what he's seeing. He is seeing a vision of God himself. And in a sense, you can put it together a little bit. There is a heavenly chariot being described, these wheels, and this kind of chariot box that has out on the side the face of a human, the face of a lion, the face of an eagle, and the face of a bull. We'll explain that in just a second. There is some stuff we can look at there. And up above that, riding on the chariot, he describes this great, bright, brilliant expanse, shining, that he can't even look at. It is Yahweh on his temple throne, much like Isaiah chapter 6 and the vision Isaiah has. And just like Isaiah, if you remember way back then when I talked about that, that vision is actually Yahweh coming out of his throne and coming out to the people, the train robe filling the temple, coming out. In the same way, this is Yahweh, in a sense, riding out of the clouds, coming down in all of his glory, all of his majesty, all of his sovereignty. And Ezekiel gets to the end of this after he's done describing this, and it's like, uh-oh, and just boom, falls down. A good way to test some of the many books running around in our culture right now about how we see God and stuff and how people have dreamed of going to see Jesus in heaven. A good way to test that is, do they fall down? Because there's not a single place in the Bible where they don't fall down like Ezekiel does. Keep that in mind. Ezekiel sees the majesty of Yahweh unlike anything he could describe. The brilliance and the glory and the majesty defies his ability to even talk about it. So this vision is a vision of the glory of Yahweh. And it sets the trajectory for the entire book. This book, Ezekiel, unlike any other book in the Old Testament, is about the glory of Yahweh. And this is why, for me, it is an exhilarating book. It's a wonderful, thrilling book. It's the story of the glory of Yahweh with his people.
My question, it's always struck me, he doesn't say it's the appearance of the glory of Yahweh. He says it's the appearance of the likeness of the glory. Now, I'm always taking that as being important, even with this vision, even somewhat the presence of Yahweh. The prophet can't describe the glory of Yahweh. He describes something that is like the glory of
That's
Yahweh.
Right.
Is that
valid? I think that's a valid observation. Rick is bringing up how it talks about seeing the likeness of the glory of Yahweh. I think it just points to the fact that he can't even put his hands around
it.
And whether or not he's actually seeing it or not, or something sort of like it, figure it out and go write a commentary. I don't know. Perhaps so, yeah. I mean, we in the New Testament, you see about the image of God as Jesus himself. Maybe that's going on. I mean, honestly, I just don't know. All I know is that Ezekiel is dumbfounded by this. He's overwhelmed by it. And he bows down in worship as he's struck with something that is communicating the glory of Yahweh in a way that blows every neuron in his brain, just explodes it. So this vision, I think, how did it get to be 9:50 already? This vision... This vision communicates at least two things for the rest of the book of Ezekiel. Remember, the beginning of a book and the end of the book are sometimes and most often the most important parts of a book. So this vision sends us off for the rest of the book, and it communicates at least two things. First, it communicates that Yahweh's glory transcends all reality. Transcends everything. There's only one thing that is actually real in this world. It's Yahweh's glory. His glory is what is real and transcends everything. This is, I think, why the prophet is struggling to wrap his mind around this. There is no way to describe this. This is majesty at its infinite reality that is indescribable. This is a picture and a portrait of how, I mean, I'm even struggling right now how to even just talk about this. Just, that is so far above our imagination or comprehension. That's God. And on the flip side, this is why, in my opinion, Ezekiel is always referred to as son of man. Literally, human being. Humanity. You're human. And all throughout this book in Ezekiel is this sense that Yahweh's just up there, just bright and shining and glorious and majestic. And Ezekiel's constantly reminded, you have nothing to do with that. You're human. You're just a creature. You're just kind of there. And with Yahweh's little pinky finger, he can just kind of knock you off. Because he is so majestic, so glorious, you can't not even comprehend because of your humanness. It's because Ezekiel's the son of man, he can't describe what he's seeing. Secondly, Yahweh's glory stands sovereign over all. So in this vision, we see that he transcends all reality, and then we see that he stands gloriously sovereign over everything that is not part of him and this vision that we're seeing. So this aspect, we can definitely pick up through some parts of this vision, through kind of three things I see here. First, in the vision, we see all sorts of pictures of royalness. A lot of these things that show up in chapter 1 are actually little bits and pieces that in the ancient Near East would communicate to somebody, something very royal is here. There's a royal image here. So for instance, the kind of composite figure that we have here of the human, but eagle, but lion, but bull kind of figure, that is in the ancient Near East in different sorts of ways. Most kings, for Babylonian kings, had something like this at the entrance of their palaces. Look at this. Here we have a figurine who has the legs of a lion, who has the wings of an eagle, and yet has the face of the king. This is a composite figure. This is sort of like what Ezekiel is seeing here. These are meant to kind of be the passageway that leads in people to see the king. And so the vision Ezekiel is having is this kind of composite figure who's representing the passageway into Yahweh himself. Secondly, we have this repetition of four all throughout chapter one. I don't know if any of you saw that, but all these series of four. Four is also a royal image. For instance, when kings in the ancient Near East wanted to kind of show their stuff and say what a great guy they are, they would say something like this: I am King Hammurabi, king of Sumer and Akkad, king of the four corners of the world. And so I think, and many agree with this, that the imagery of four is, again, royal imagery covering all four points of the compass in as many ways as possible to show that God is king over everything. Third and finally, the whole picture, as I just mentioned, is the vision of a chariot rider. It is the king riding on his chariot, and there's a slight ominous note to it. Why do you ride on a chariot? War. Yahweh is coming out for war. As king of creation, as king of the universe, he is declaring war on his people. And that's what shocks Ezekiel in chapter 2 and 3. Ezekiel is just dumbfounded by this. We're going to bypass that. Ezekiel is just dumbfounded by this idea that God is coming to basically declare war on the very people he says he's going to protect. And Ezekiel doesn't know what to do with this. So his neurons were just blown up by this vision. Now his neurons are just blown up by this call that he's given in chapters 2 and 3 of how he's going to stand against Israel. And again, what happens throughout all these chapters is kind of this constant refrain that everything that Yahweh is, the people are not. And the people, through the story of the Bible, as we've talked about, are called to image the glory of Yahweh. And Yahweh is essentially coming down saying, they're not only not imaging me, they're imaging something so startling, so graphic, so horrible, that the only language I can use to describe it peels the skin off your back when you read it. So read Ezekiel 16 sometime with your children and then cover their ears. Because it's meant to be horrible language. You're meant to read it and just feel like icky all over and feel like, I hope they don't read this on Sunday morning from the pulpit. And you're meant to feel that. And as I've said before, we allow yourself to feel these things when you're reading the Bible. You need to feel them. You need to be brought into the text and feel those icky moments. And then ask yourself, why? Why did God want his people to feel this and feel this way? And you'll start getting at the bottom of things like here, just the shocking contrast between Yahweh's beauty, Yahweh's precious glory and his majesty and how wonderful he is, compared to what we look like when we're not imaging him. And how what we're actually imaging to the world when we're not walking in step with God, what we're actually imaging to the world is this. Things like chapter 16. That's what it looks like to God. And at the bottom of all of this is, once again, Israel has a heart of stone, right? A rebellious house. And we talked a lot about this last week, so I'm not going to unpack this right now. But Israel at bottom is a rebellious house. They have at bottom a heart problem, that their heart keeps producing all these images that we're seeing that are horrific. As John Calvin says, the heart is a factory of idols. He's reading the Old Testament right. That humanity, son of man, Ezekiel, is an idol factory. And God says, I'm going to destroy it. And I'm going to wipe it out and destroy the idol factory, no matter what it takes. Then we come to the most horrifying judgment of all the entire Old Testament. Chapters 8 through 11 are the most terrifying pieces of literature that the entire Bible has. So in chapter 8, you start opening up the scene of the temple and how things are not good there. And what you have happen from chapter 8, 9, 10 is this progression in which the glory of Yahweh, Ezekiel sees this vision where the glory of Yahweh is first on the Holy of Holies over the cherubim, and then Ezekiel says it rises up and moves out of the Holy of Holies. That's when you should start getting nervous. And then the presence of God takes more steps in chapter 9 and moves out farther and comes down to the main temple area. And by the time we get to chapter 11, the glory of Yahweh, which belongs in the temple where his presence is to dwell with his people and bring harmony, has moved out of the temple and is now coming to leave Jerusalem. And this recalls all this kind of flashback of the entire Old Testament story that we just don't have time to talk about now. But think with me through the many books of the Bible we have talked about over the last couple years. And think about this story that's evolving through this. Beginning with chapter 1 of Genesis, we have this story in which God creates a world where his presence is supposed to dwell with the people of God. And that's what the world was, that's how the world was meant to be. And then we saw how in chapter 3, essentially, the humanity gets kicked out from this cosmic sanctuary that's supposed to take place. And how the most horrifying thing that happens in chapter 3 is that the people are removed from the presence of God, where they're going to be satisfied, where they're going to have joy in that sense. Well, then God, as we talked about, God launches a rescue mission in Genesis 12, essentially a rescue mission to create a new people who can live with his presence. And then he redeems them in the book of Exodus, right? And he becomes king over them. And then remember how the book of Exodus ends. Who remembers? What happens at the very end of Exodus? That's right. John said, God's glory fills the tabernacle. And I talked about it in the past about at the end of Exodus, the ancient readers are reading that going, yes, God's moving in. He's come back. And then we find out it doesn't go so well. In fact, it goes horribly wrong. But along the way, we have these kind of up points, like 1 Kings, where Solomon builds the temple. And this is the highlight of the entire history of Israel, because finally we have a localized place where the presence of God can dwell with his people and bring life out to his people in 1 Kings. That leads us then to the exile, where here now in Ezekiel 8 through 11, the glory leaves, dismantling. Then the glory of Yahweh went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mountain that is on the east side of the city. This is not a warm, cozy, tender moment with the glory of Yahweh. This is a terrifying reality that everything that the Old Testament narrative is aiming at, God is basically saying, it's over. This is Genesis 3 all over again. The people being removed from the presence of Yahweh, which brings life. It's horrifying. It's startling. It's disturbing. And we should read it and in it see this is what our sin did. It required the removal of the presence of Yahweh himself in that sense. So the remaining chapters of this first section, chapters 12 through 24, is all about painting a picture of this is what happens when Yahweh's glory leaves us. It paints this horrible picture of how the people just are seen as having no restraints now and rushing into sin and rushing into judgment. As soon as Yahweh leaves, it's also the battle call for the armies to then essentially descend upon Jerusalem and destroy it, because they could not destroy Jerusalem until the presence of Yahweh removed itself and said, I'm done with this city. And so this whole section ends in chapter 24, verse 1 through 2, with this very disturbing call to Ezekiel. In the ninth year, in the tenth month, on the tenth day of the month, the word of Yahweh came to me, Son of man, write down the name of this day, this very day. The king of Babylon has laid siege to Jerusalem this very day. So this section ends with this sense that this is what happens when the presence of God leaves. Judgment, destruction, pain. This is Genesis chapters 4 through 11 all over again. Think of it that way. It's the same story being told again. Removed from the garden, and chaos breaks out. Yahweh's presence leaves Jerusalem now, and chaos breaks out. This leads us to the second section in our last 10 minutes. The sovereign glory of Yahweh judges all the nations, especially Jerusalem. And this one we can go through quick. Now Ezekiel jumps back and looks like at the wide screen, and suddenly instead of just Jerusalem, he sees the entire universe. And he sees how the entire world is being judged by God, especially because the nations here, they seem to almost be mocking Yahweh for allowing Jerusalem to fall apart. And they're kind of like saying to Yahweh, you must not be a good, strong God. And Yahweh rides out essentially against the nations to defend not Jerusalem, but to defend his honor, and basically saying, I was justified to do this. And so to show you I'm justified, I'm going to wipe you off the map, Edom. I'm going to wipe off you off the map, Moab and Philistia and Tyre and Egypt. I'm going to wipe you guys off the map to demonstrate how my sovereign glory is not limited just to this little tiny town of Jerusalem. I own the world, oh little prince of Tyre who thinks you can raise your head above me and be more lofty than me. I am King Yahweh. And now let me show you what King Yahweh can do. Then this section ends with this climactic scene that is not just the nations, but it is in fact Jerusalem that receives the judgment of God. So in chapter 33, verse 21, now that the siege has been laid against Jerusalem, now Ezekiel feels the full force of what's going to happen to his people. Verse 21. In the 12th year of our exile, in the 10th month, on the 5th day of the month, a refugee from Jerusalem came to me and said, the city has fallen. The unthinkable has happened. It's over. And you see wailing in the streets and the unthinkable reality that God did not protect his people. And it's a strong comment to the people in exile who are sitting here going, oh, we can get back and everything's going to be okay. This illusion is just shattered for them. And they feel finally the full force of, if you don't want to live in harmony with Yahweh, Yahweh's going to leave you, and then you see what happens. See how you can do now. O human, if Yahweh's not in charge? You don't want Yahweh to be in charge? Fine. I'll let you find out what happens. And so Jerusalem falls. This then segues us, you would think, into text just mourning this and despair. But once again, be amazed that God doesn't just pack up his bags and go home. Once again, he calls the people out, Ezekiel does, and says, I'm going to bring life out of even this situation. So the final part of the book, chapters 34 through 48, the devoted glory of Yahweh restores the people of God to his presence, bringing life. So the remaining section of Ezekiel really is seen in two parts. First, we have chapters 34 through 39. And in this part, we see kind of how Yahweh promises that he's going to fix everything that's wrong with the people. He's going to change their hearts. He's actually going to do it. He's going to help them stop being so angry. He's going to help them stop being so anxious. He's going to help them stop being so controlled by these sin patterns that they just can't escape on their own. And then chapters 40 through 48 essentially says, this is how I'm going to do it. So the first half kind of shares, hey, have hope. I'm going to do something to make everything okay. And the second half answers the question of, well, how's he going to do this? Jerusalem's done. The people have hearts of stone. And Yahweh says, this now is how I'm going to do it. So part one, Yahweh promises real change in chapters 34 through 39. And here we have a lot of echoes of Jeremiah, so I'm not going to spend time really unpacking this too much. But we have a lot of echoes of things like having a new heart that's going to take place. We have a new Davidic shepherd, especially look at chapters 34 and 37, and you see this vision of how Yahweh himself says, I am going to now shepherd these people. I'm going to do it. These human princes, they keep failing. I'm going to take control now, and I'm going to essentially be the new Davidic leader. Then you have images of new Exodus. You have images of new security and hope. And all of this is kind of wrapped up and put into a story about bones in chapter 37. And you have all this imagery of how Israel are just corpses on the ground. You can certainly see why Paul in Ephesians 2:1 begins with, but as for you, you were dead. And this is kind of what Ezekiel is having this vision of as he looks out after all these promises, and he looks out kind of like, all right, this is going to be great, and then looks out, oh boy, we got a problem, and just sees piles of corpses signifying this is what the people of God look like in Israel. Piles of dead bones, rotted, just birds pecking off any remaining flesh. That's what the people look like. And then Yahweh says, oh, son of man, breathe life. I'm going to breathe life into that. I'm going to take that and raise them up and put bodies back around them and make them whole again. And so, again, we have these incredible images of just Yahweh is going to do something that is astounding. And again, like I said, I've said before, I keep saying this, don't let these things become so common to you. This is shocking. God raising the dead. Hearts of stone turned into hearts of flesh. If this is not shocking to you, here's your application. Go home and plead with God to open your eyes to how incredible this is that God would do this. Read Ezekiel 16 and then read Ezekiel 37 and you'll be shocked at how incredible God is and what he's doing. So then there's this kind of question at the end of these passages of why is Yahweh going to do this? Why is he doing this? And the text has mainly two answers here working itself out. The first is, all throughout this, you keep getting this refrain. Did you anybody see this when they were reading this? You shall know that I am Yahweh. You shall know that I am Yahweh. So in the background of all of this is exactly what happened in the book of Exodus when the same thing was said. Yahweh kept saying, Pharaoh will know that I am Yahweh. Pharaoh will know that I am Yahweh. The people will know that I am Yahweh. And here now in Ezekiel, God is saying, they will know that I am Yahweh. It's this picture of God saying, I am doing this, not for their benefit, but that the world sees who Yahweh is. He's a God marked by compassion. He's a God marked by radical mercy that defies the human imagination. And he's a God who is sovereign over every square inch. And just like he took the people from Pharaoh, he's now taking the people from the God of death himself and raising them up and saying, I'm going to change this whole situation. Secondly, and with this, he does this for the sake of Yahweh's glory. Chapter 36, verse 22. Therefore, say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, it is not for your sake, O house of Israel, that I am about to act. It is not for your sake, O people of God, that I'm doing any of this, but for the sake of my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations to which you came. He is vindicating, he is defending his honor, his glory. Think back to Ezekiel 1, this majesty, just indescribable majesty. Yahweh is saying, I'm now going to defend this because you are imaging something that smells awful and looks terrible and does not display what I'm really like. And so Yahweh defends his glory through this. Then the question is, how is he going to do this? In our remaining moments, how is he going to do this? Well, there's a bit of a hint at the end of chapter 39. Chapter 39 ends in the very last verse, and I will not hide my face, or a better word maybe, I will not hide my presence anymore from them. When I pour out my spirit upon the house of Israel, declares the Lord God. And then immediately we're ushered into chapter 40, where we have this incredible vision of the temple. Do you see this? Chapter 39 ends with, I will not hide my presence from them. I'm going to pour out my spirit. And then immediately you get a vision of the temple, the longing of Israel. Everything that was wrong is being restored. And so you have this shocking picture of a new temple being created. And what is most glorious is when Ezekiel sees in chapter 43, beginning in verse 1, then he led me to the gate facing east. And behold, or really, look, the glory! The glory of the God of Israel is coming from the east. And the sound of his coming was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. And the vision I saw was just like the vision that I had seen when he came to destroy the city, chapter 1. And just like the vision that I had seen by the Kabar Canal, and I fell on my face as the glory of the Lord entered the temple by the gate facing east. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of Yahweh filled the temple. This should thrill you, ancient Israelite reader. Genesis 1, he's saying, is back. It's restored. And as a result, healing goes out. Chapters 47 through 48, we don't have time to read. But you see this picture of water coming out of the temple and flooding the land and causing fruit to grow up and trees and bringing healing to the land. And why is it? It's because the glory of Yahweh heals, it satisfies. The land and humanity was designed to flourish only in the presence of Yahweh. And what we see here is at the bottom of all of our sin, at the bottom of every heart problem I have, is at root a problem that I am seeking to be satisfied with everything else but the majesty and the glory and the healing waters of God Himself. And so when God restores this, Yahweh saying, I'm going to satisfy everything. You will no longer seek satisfaction elsewhere. You will no longer be anxious. You will no longer be frustrated. You will no longer be stuck with brokenness. But the glory of Yahweh Himself, Emmanuel, God is with us. Here's a Christmas story. This is the Christmas story right here. As God becomes the temple, shockingly, in a man. And His name is Jesus. Right? I'm going way off course now. So Ezekiel ends by essentially transforming all the four themes of the Pentateuch that we've talked about in the past. Theme of the leader, the search for the leader, the seed, right? The search for the temple and land and the search for the people. All of this is funneled down in the story of the Old Testament into this vision of the temple being restored and Yahweh's presence coming back and everything being okay now. And Ezekiel ends, I'm sorry I'm rushing, Ezekiel ends with these very last words. Did anybody pick this up? The final words of the book of Ezekiel. Verse 35, the circumference of the city shall be 18,000 cubits. Memorize that, okay? And the name of the city from that time on, and here comes the last words. The name of the city shall be what? Yahweh, the Lord, is there. He's there. He's there. Emmanuel. Message of Ezekiel, then we're going to end. The glory of Yahweh residing with His people in the new cosmic sanctuary is the only hope for the broken people of God. This is the story of the Old Testament. This is why I said at the beginning, Ezekiel, I think, is the most important book in the entire Old Testament. The story of Yahweh's glory being restored to the people of God. And in a radical, unthinkable way that would have blown Ezekiel's neurons even further, somehow he did it. By becoming flesh Himself and being slaughtered on a cross and pouring out the Spirit upon us and inviting us into His presence because of that. Father, I pray as we go from here that You would shock us with the vision of the majesty of Yahweh. That we would be truly satisfied with Yahweh Himself. For what we were designed for. Let us run to You and expose to us every area of our life that is not running to the presence of Yahweh. Amen.